everyone. Happy New Year. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie. As you could probably tell from the title of the episode, this isn't a normal Court Junkie episode. Instead, I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about the cases I covered in 2018, as well as to give you some updates on a few of them. So before I get started, if there are any episodes from 2018 that you have not listened to yet, it would probably be a good idea to make sure you're all caught up on them before continuing on with this one. I don't want to spoil any of them for you. But for everyone else, let's get into it. The very first case I covered in 2018 was the trial of Timothy Batts. It was undisputed that Timothy tragically shot and killed his 11-year-old daughter, Tamia, in August of 2016. It was even undisputed that Timothy didn't intend on killing his daughter, or even intend on shooting her. Timothy told police that he had thought Tamia was an intruder, and even prosecutors believed that that was the case. But the big question was, what should the punishment be? And as you might recall, Timothy had a prior criminal history. He was a convicted felon and wasn't even supposed to be in possession of a gun. And many people believe that because of that, his punishment was more harsh than someone who didn't have such a history. Timothy was eventually found guilty of being in possession of a gun and of tampering with evidence. If you remember, he admittedly panicked and hid the gun after what happened. But the jury was hung on the main charge, reckless homicide. Just prior to his sentencing, Timothy reached an agreement with prosecutors. He would plead guilty in exchange for the recommendation that his sentence for illegally possessing a firearm be served concurrently. The judge in the case sentenced him to serve 4 years in prison. And that's where Timothy still is today. After I released that episode, I heard from a number of you listeners who told me that you were conflicted about the case. I think it's always easier to be confident that someone deserves jail time when there's an intent behind the act. But when something is an accident or is reckless, your feelings may not always be black and white. And to be honest, that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to cover that case. As you guys know, I don't like to give my opinion on any of these cases. That's not what this podcast is about. It's not about me and my opinions on things, but it's about having real discussions and awareness about things that really do happen in society and the cases that make their way through our justice system. I thought that covering this case would open up some good discussions, and hopefully it did. Moving on to the next case, Heather Elvis. Now, this was one that I followed back when Heather first disappeared, and it's one that I knew I wanted to cover as soon as the trials for the accused began. I actually dedicated 2 episodes to this one. Episode 45, where I covered Sydney Moore's trial for kidnapping, as well as obstruction of justice. And then episode 62, where I covered the other suspect, Sydney's wife Tammy Moore's trial. Now, just to give a very brief recap, Heather Elvis was 20 years old in 2013 when prosecutors say she was kidnapped from Peachtree Boat Landing near Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The facts of the case are that Heather had a relationship with Sydney Moore, who was married to Tammy Moore. According to Heather's friends and to Sydney himself, that ended in October of 2013, after Tammy found out about it. Heather's cell phone shows that her very last call was to Sydney's cell phone from the landing. So naturally, Sydney and Tammy became the number one suspects. Sydney went to trial first for kidnapping, and the jury was hung on that charge. He later went to trial again for obstruction of justice and was found guilty. He's currently serving time in prison for that charge and is awaiting his retrial on the kidnapping charge. Tammy went to trial for kidnapping and conspiracy to commit kidnapping also, and she was found guilty. The judge sentenced her to 30 years for each charge. Now, this case is one that I think will actually be ongoing for quite some time. Sydney was just up for parole in November of 2018 on that obstruction of justice conviction. He told the partial parole board, which is used for nonviolent offenders, that he knows what he did was wrong, but that he didn't intend on obstructing justice. When asked what he did to prepare for his parole hearing, he said he was trying to better himself. He asked for a second chance and asked to be released. Heather's family, however, was also there, and they asked for his parole to be denied. They said that Sydney hasn't shown any remorse, and they said he continues to lie about Heather's disappearance. The hearing lasted for a total of about 15 minutes, and his parole was denied. We still don't have a date for Sydney's retrial, but I'm definitely going to keep my eye on that. And in the meantime, Heather is still missing. This past December marked the 5-year anniversary of her disappearance, and Heather's loved ones gathered to remember her. In my mind, I'm sort of left wondering if there will ever be murder charges filed in this case, especially after the jury found Tammy guilty of kidnapping. So would it be a stretch to think that a jury might find her guilty of murder, even if Heather is never found? I guess time will tell, but it's a case that I will definitely continue to follow. Todd Kendhammer was another case that elicited a lot of emails from my listeners. Many of you said it was a case where you went back and forth between believing Todd's story to not believing his story. And just to recap, I covered this case in episode 46. Todd Kendhammer was accused of murdering his wife and staging the scene to look like a giant pipe went through his windshield while driving down the road, resulting in the tragic death of his wife, Barbara Kendhammer. Todd was found guilty of murder and was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 30 years. This trial was interesting, to me at least, because I really wanted to believe Todd's story. And according to a lot of your emails, many of you felt the same way. You didn't want to believe that this seemingly nice man, who had no known history of any kind of violence whatsoever, would kill his wife in cold blood. And in fact, many of you even disagreed with the verdict. As for updates in this case, Todd has retained a new attorney for his appeal, Jerome Buting. And if that name sounds familiar to you, that's likely because Jerome Buting appeared on Making a Murderer as one of Stephen Avery's attorneys. In episode 47, I covered the case of real estate agent Beverly Carter. I spoke with Beverly's son, Carl Jr., who told me about his mother's murder, the trial of the man responsible, and about the Beverly Carter Foundation, a foundation he founded in honor of his mother's memory. As you'll recall, Beverly, who was 50 years old at the time, went to show a house one day in September 2014, just outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. The man she went to meet, Aaron Lewis, pretended that he and his wife were interested in purchasing the house, but in reality, they had a plan to kidnap Beverly because they believed that she was a rich real estate agent. Aaron was arrested and charged with murder, and his wife Crystal was also arrested, although she pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 30 years in prison in exchange for testifying against Aaron. Aaron testified at his trial as well, and he had this very disgusting, sordid tale that I'm not going to go over again, but he essentially claimed that Beverly died during a sexual encounter with Crystal. It was such an unbelievable story that the jury took less than an hour to find him guilty of capital murder and kidnapping. This case is one that I will absolutely never forget. Anytime I have the honor of speaking with someone close to the case, it just makes it hit home that much more. And Carl Jr. is such a strong, inspiring person who was determined to not let his mother's death go without having created some good in the world. And I believe he's doing that through the Beverly Carter Foundation. After I released the episode, it just so happened that Carl Jr. came to Chicago. He was in town for a work conference and also to meet up with someone on the board of the Beverly Carter Foundation. We met up at a local coffee shop in the city and we talked about the episode and how he felt like it was therapeutic for him to talk about it like he did. And we also just talked about our lives, kind of like old friends do. I know a lot of you felt the same way about Carl Jr. after hearing the episode, and I know he was really touched by all of the great feedback you sent me, which I then forwarded on to him. Episode 50 was about an 8-year-old girl named Layla Fowler from Valley Springs, California. This was such a horrible and tragic case. Layla was found deceased in her home on April 27, 2013. She had been stabbed multiple times. At the time, Layla was home with her 12-year-old brother, Isaiah, who told police that he was in the bathroom when a man came into their home and attacked his sister. But police didn't believe Isaiah's story, and he was arrested 15 days after the murder. Isaiah's family stood by him and told reporters that he was innocent. Isaiah pleaded not guilty to second-degree murder with a special allegation for use of a dangerous weapon. He went to trial in juvenile court in September of 2015. The judge found him guilty and sentenced him to 16 years to life in prison. But because he was a juvenile, he was scheduled to be released at the age of 23. Now, at the end of the episode, I told you that in February 2018, Isaiah's conviction was thrown out and a new trial was ordered. The reason for the new trial was because the appeals court found that the juvenile court, quote, erroneously admitted Isaiah's pre-arrest statements in violation of Miranda v. Arizona. So they were saying that Isaiah's statements to police should not have been admissible at his trial. Well, in June 2018, Isaiah went on trial again. According to news reports, minus the statements Isaiah had made to police, some of the testimony from the first trial was submitted via transcripts. The trial lasted for 3 days, and after reviewing all of the evidence, the judge found Isaiah guilty once again. Isaiah's family has not strayed from their belief that Isaiah is innocent. His attorney said he plans to take the case back to the Sacramento Appeals Court, and that if that doesn't work, he'll bring the case to the California Governor's Office for a possible pardon. Episode 52 covered the case of Reagan Toks. Reagan was a 21-year-old Ohio State University student who was murdered on the night of February 8, 2017. Reagan had just left work and was walking to her car when she was forced into her car by a man she did not know, who then kidnapped and killed her. The thing about Reagan's case that stood out to me was how the killer, a man named Brian Goolsbee, had been out on parole and had been wearing an ankle monitor the night that she was killed. Brian had quite a scary criminal past, including instances of horrific violence against women. And not only that, but when Brian was serving time in prison for those crimes, he was less than an ideal inmate. He racked up 45 citations. Yet when his 6-year prison term had ended, he was fitted with an ankle monitor and released. And that's when he went on to kidnap and kill Reagan. I told you in the episode how Reagan's family started working with legislators to pass the Reagan Toks Act, which would change how violent offenders in Ohio are sentenced. Well, just a few weeks ago, in December 2018, a portion of the Reagan Toks Act was signed into law. That portion allows a judge to sentence a violent offender to a range of years in prison, as opposed to a set term. So if that offender then racks up citations while in prison, as Brian Goolsbee did, he could spend more time in prison. But if that offender is well-behaved, on the other hand, he could then serve less. Reagan's family told reporters that they feel that the bill will help make Ohio safer. My most downloaded episode of 2018 was the episode I did on the Christopher Coleman case. That was back in episode 56, entitled Tragedy in Columbia, Illinois. This was the second case I've done since starting Court Junkie that involved a father murdering his entire family, his wife, his kids, just a really despicable, heinous, and atrocious act. In November 2008, 31-year-old Sherry Coleman and her two young sons, 11-year-old Garrett and 9-year-old Gavin, were found deceased in their home in Columbia, Illinois. Sherry's husband, Christopher Coleman, was convicted of the murders after a grueling trial in which Christopher's defense tried to claim that he had nothing to do with it. But the prosecution's evidence was overwhelming. The family had allegedly been receiving death threats in the months leading up to the murders, and the prosecution introduced evidence that the threats actually came from Christopher's own computer. He was sentenced to 3 life sentences. This was another case that I had followed back when it first happened, and one that I again knew that I wanted to eventually cover. But what really made it my mind was an email I received from one of Sherry's cousin's friends. That friend sent me a link to a news article about the case and asked if I would be able to cover it in an episode. She told me that her friend Jenna, who was Sherry's cousin, would definitely be interested in talking about it. So I reached out to Jenna, and she helped me with the episode. She gave me some family background, talked about how she found out about what had happened, what Sherry and her little boys were like, and that's essentially how I put that episode together. Christopher Coleman is still in prison, although he is seeking a new trial. As you'll recall, Christopher had been having an affair with a woman named Tara, who also happened to be a friend of Sherry's. And at trial, some explicit photos of the two of them were introduced. Photos that Christopher's defense team is saying should have never been admissible. So if there's any update on that front, I'll be sure to let you know. The last episode of the year doesn't have an update, but I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about it anyway. It's an episode that, I'm not going to lie, is one of my favorites, for lack of a better term. And what I mean by that is, I put a lot of thought into the way I wanted to present the facts of the case. And I do that for every episode to a certain extent. But for this one, I had a very specific goal in mind, one that meant a lot to me to be able to carry it out. And that goal was to make Gennaro Sanchez the main focal point of the story again. Before I get into what I mean by that, here's a quick recap of the case. In December 2012, 18-year-old Gennaro Sanchez was shot and killed by a fellow student named Jared Murray at East Central University in Ada, Oklahoma. When questioned by investigators about why he did it, Jared said he had wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone. And when asked if he felt remorse, he said he only regretted being caught so quickly. The interrogation is extremely eerie. Jared sounds like a polite college kid. He says, "Yes, sir," and "No, sir." And he's extremely calm and matter-of-fact as he describes the murder. When I first heard about this case, it was because I came across Jared's interrogation video, which you can find all over the internet, including on YouTube. And in fact, if you Google anything about this case, the main stories that come up are all about Jared, and there's very little mention of his victim, Gennaro. I started looking more into Gennaro, and I found a Facebook page run by his aunt called In Memory of G. His aunt keeps it pretty updated, and there was one entry in particular that caught my eye, where she talked about how upset the family was by some of the coverage the case had gotten. I decided to reach out to her to see if she would be interested in helping me tell Gennaro's story. She put me in touch with Gennaro's mom, who I interviewed in the episode. So after I interviewed Gennaro's mom, I remember hanging up the phone with her. About an hour and a half worth of audio saved on my computer that I would then go through to see what pieces of audio clips would go where in the episode. And I remember feeling not overwhelmed necessarily, but determined. I wanted to make sure I told the story in a thoughtful and respectful way, and I wanted to make sure that the focus was on Gennaro, his family, what they've had to go through, and changes to the law that they advocated for. I knew I had to include a lot of Jared's interrogation. It's a central part of the story after all, and you really get a feel for the eeriness he conveys when he's speaking to the detectives. But other than the interrogation, which took up about 20 minutes of the episode, I wanted to make sure that the remaining 40 minutes or so was filled with more about Gennaro himself and his family and how missed he is. I remember when I was talking to Gennaro's mom, she said Jared at one point had referred to Gennaro as, quote, "that boy." He didn't even care enough to know his name, I remember her telling me. And that's when I decided I wanted to call the episode, "His Name Was Gennaro Sanchez." After I released the episode, I had quite a number of people reach out, some people who even knew Gennaro. And although you can never be sure when you release your episode if you accomplished your goal, I'm hopeful that I did. But either way, it serves as a reminder to myself that these people that we all hear about through various true crime mediums are real people with real family members and loved ones who are immensely affected by what happened. And I don't think that I could ever be successful with this podcast if I ever forget that fact. Lastly, I want to close out the episode by sharing some highlights of making this podcast in 2018. The first highlight involves bringing on more people to the Court Junkie team. As most of you know, I've always been pretty much a one-person show. I do the majority of the research, watch the trials, conduct the interviews, write the scripts, choose the music, and then put everything together to make the episode. I try to be present on as many social media channels as I can, and to promote each episode the best I can, although that is admittedly not my strong suit. Then, once the episode is completed on my end, I record a rough draft and let some of my loved ones listen to it for any mistakes or any lapses in the storytelling. And then I make any necessary changes before recording the final version. I then send the final version over to John over at Wayfair Recordings, who then puts the finishing touches on it and makes it sound nice and smooth. I would be lost without John. He is absolutely wonderful. And in 2018, I was excited to bring on some additional help. Jane, who helps me with the research for some of the episodes, and Scott, a legal assistant who helps me file all of my Freedom of Information Act requests and just answers various legal questions I have. So a big thank you to them. Another highlight from the year was getting to know the various people I interviewed for my episodes, from victims' family members to courtroom reporters to law professors and defense attorneys. I'm always particularly fond of the episodes where I can feature interviews and soundbites from people close to the case. I think it helps me be more accurate with my reporting and also helps make the stories more personal and relatable. And then there are the big podcasting milestones I reached in 2018. Milestones I could have never reached without the amazing support of all of you listening. The first one being that I passed the 10 million downloads mark, which is absolutely unbelievable to me. I never would have believed it if you had told me that I would hit that mark back when I first started this podcast. And then there are smaller milestones, but ones just as important, to me anyway. There are now 12,000 members in the Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook, and more than 600 people support this podcast on Patreon, which absolutely blows my mind. That people would donate their hard-earned money towards this podcast is so amazing, and I want to thank all of my Patreon supporters so very much. As for what's next, in 2019, I'm planning on adding some additional content in the form of mini episodes to Patreon. And I'm also planning on expanding the Court Junkie team and hiring some more researchers and also some writers. So stay tuned, because I'm hoping that 2019 is an even better year for Court Junkie. And that's all for this New Year's episode. I want to thank all of you Court Junkies for such a wonderful year. My next regular episode will be out on Monday, January 21st. So make sure you subscribe so you don't miss it. Thanks for listening. Until next time.